Warning, the following podcast may contain information that is sensitive to the average listener or to anyone under the age of 18. Topics in this podcast usually range from suicide, murder, violence, and sexual assault. If any of these topics make you uneasy, or if you are under the age of 18 and did not seek parental permission to listen to this episode, please turn this podcast off now. Otherwise, sit back, relax, and enjoy today's episode. Additionally, information about this case and who to contact should you have any tips will be listed at the end of today's episode. Enjoy. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another episode of From the Vault right here on Anchor FM and wherever you can find your favorite podcast. I'm Jason Futch, and alongside with me is my buddy from the Bay, Nick Wagler. How you doing, my friend?
Doing well. How about yourself?
Doing good. Can you believe it, man? You know, we've known each other like, what, maybe a couple years now, and we're literally probably like the closest we've been in a long time.
Yeah, it is kind of interesting. Like, now I'm up in, well, I should say down in southern Wisconsin now, and you're not too far away in Iowa.
Yeah, right? Like, I never thought I would ever record an episode of my podcast in Iowa, of all places.
Mm-hmm. And plus, we're in the same time zone, so that's pretty great.
yeah, see, and that works to our advantage, so that works amazing. But yeah, I'm over here in Cedar Rapids, Iowa for truck driving school, guys, and it's been an adventure so far. And Nick, I know you're heading back over to UW over in Green Bay, so we've been doing our share of moving around this last couple of weeks.
Oh yeah, like I moved into campus a few days ago, and so far all of my classes are still in line, but you know, it's kind of nice just to be in the area
and actually have something to do, right?
Yeah besides, you know, working and all that other good stuff.
Sure, totally. Yeah, so, you know, and that's the thing about our schedules, it's going to be a little different. So we're trying to make sure that we can get some content to everybody while we're moving around a lot. And I can definitely tell you guys, we are really, really busy right now with this new podcast. And for those of you who listened to our previous episode, this is actually part of our inaugural episodes that are coming out for From the Vault. So it's been a pretty exciting couple of episodes. In fact, this episode here is going to be probably just as dramatic as the last one we discussed on Robert and Frieda Wheatley, wouldn't you think?
Most definitely. You know, we found a lot of really cool information on this case that I guess neither of us knew beforehand. And I guess that's the perks of newspapers.com and browsing the web and all that.
Yeah, you know? I mean, I wish that newspapers.com could just go ahead and give us a sponsorship right now, you know.
Absolutely.
Free access and everything, so that way they know that their services are being put to good use. I mean, you know, mm-hmm. And it's the truth, is like newspapers are becoming a thing of the past now. They're moving from physical copies to digital copies, and so, hey, at least we're utilizing this new form of newspaper access, so I guess you could say.
Well, yeah, like I know even when I was doing the research for the Walker County Jane Doe podcast, like I looked through newspapers and I found some information about the case that I wasn't aware of before, and you can always find a lot of new information despite it being old, you know, in these decades old publications that, you know, sometimes the details are either left out or they just don't make it into mainstream media. So
yeah, certainly, you know, it and I think honestly, when you look back at newspapers, like if you can go back to the earliest that the incident occurred,
word?
I feel like that would probably be some of the most accurate representations of the case that, you know, we're covering, because it's fresh, it just happened at that time period, and things might not be so skewered as maybe 20 years down the line, you get a reporter who probably wasn't even born in that year, go ahead and cover something they don't know anything about and add false information in those cases.
Yeah, and another thing too, you know, I guess a downside is at the same time, we know when it just happens, they don't know all the specifics yet. Like, I do remember reading, like, they initially thought Walker County Jane Doe could have been as old as 22, and, you know, now it's generally believed she was no more than 18, and she was probably a lot younger than that, probably closer to about 15, 16.
Sure, and that would make more sense, you know, that mm-hmm. would make a lot more sense, considering that's about the age that one would run away at. Mm-hmm. You know, nonetheless, though, we are talking about Millie Doe, our Spokane, Washington Jane Doe. She was found in 1984 on the Spokane River. Now, this is probably going to be one of the most brutal and graphic cases that we've covered together, Nick. And this mm-hmm. was a very, very savage case of murder and real hate. I mean, the way that this woman was killed goes to show that whoever did it must have really hated her fucking guts.
And I agree, you know, there is a lot of kind of animosity towards this victim. It's definitely not pleasant when, you know, we get down to the details of the murder and what was done after. She was obviously spending the last few moments of her life in utter fear. You know, there's not a doubt in my mind.
Mm-hmm. And later when we do cover this case, there's some theories that do abound that will make you think, oh my God, did she actually have to deal, like, did she really deal with the pain that was inflicted on her in her final moments? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, normally when someone is murdered, it happens fast. Or, well, you can have an asshole for a killer and they go real slow, make you feel every bit of pain. But as we progress through this case today, listeners, you guys are going to hear about some very violent and brutal stuff. And if you are very sensitive to descriptions about sexual assault or murder, I would suggest that you move on to another podcast, because we are going to get really in depth with this case. And I know for our listeners, most of you have probably already heard of this case, but there's going to be some interesting details that you may or may not know about in this case. I mean, hell, Nick has been researching unidentified persons for years, same as I, but we found some interesting stuff that we didn't even know about in Millie's case.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this was actually one of the first Jane Doe cases I had come across when I first really got into researching. You know, I was 17, and of course, you know, this is kind of a graphic case to first read about, but you know, it's kind of stuck with me, and it's one of the few really big cases, I guess, that were close to me that hasn't gotten solved yet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's very interesting. You know, there were a couple of close calls, you know, regarding her identification, but they ended up falling flat. So, you know, she's still unidentified after so many years. And, you know, it's going to be 4 years from now before this case turns 40. What I would like to see happen is, before that even happens, that this case gets solved. So we hope that this podcast will definitely help in some way, trigger our listeners about, you know, what happened, if they know something, to report it. And toward the end, we will have information on who you can call if you do have information regarding this cold case. So with that being said, before we do continue on our episode today, I do want to go ahead and send a special Patreon shout out to our good friend Kaylara. She is our very first Patreon patron. She has chosen the official patron class, which is only $5. Now, $5 surprisingly can get you a lot on Patreon. She is going to have early access to our episodes, and then occasionally she will have access to special goodies courtesy of our podcast on Patreon. So thank you so much, Kaylara. You've also been a really good friend to Nick and I and to the true crime community, and you've done a lot of good stuff out there, and we still hope that you do this for a very long time. time and stay with us too.
Yeah, we're definitely glad to have her here. I know she's always been enthusiastic with the posts that I've shared throughout Twitter, as well as what my co-admin has also shared. And you can definitely tell she's very passionate about these cases, and she's also helped solve a few. So, you know, this is definitely flattering, you know, that somebody who is this prominent, you know, is signing up to.
Absolutely. Yeah, you know, we definitely appreciate Kaylara's support, and we invite everybody who's listening, if you want cool shit, you want early access to our episodes, become an official patron today, or just sign up for a higher tier, and you get more cool things like monthly drawings for merchandise. You get free merch after your 6 months in with us, period. And occasionally we might throw in some free stuff. So go ahead and join us today on Patreon if you haven't already. www.patreon.com/fromthevaultpod and get started today. I mean, we've got a $5 tier, $10 tier, $20 tier, and a $30 tier. And that $30 tier will get you so much, including police report access and everything else that's included with our other memberships. So go to Patreon and get started today, please, 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 please. Anyways, folks, and also before the show, I want to go ahead and let everybody know that our show today is sponsored by Anchor FM. So if you guys have ever wanted to start a podcast, go ahead and sign up for your free podcast today at anchor.fm. You can do anything from comedy, drama, crime, stuff like that. Anything you want to do. If you want to start a podcast solely on woodworking, that's something you can do as well. So go to Anchor FM and get started today. And heck, you get paid with no minimum listenership. It's all you need in a podcast app. So go to anchor.fm today and get started. And finally, today our sponsor is crimewatchers.net. In pursuit of the missing, the unidentified, and justice. Every case that we cover on From the Vault, you can find on Crime Watchers. You can join in on the conversation. It's free to join Crime Watchers. It's just another crime web. It's another crime forum board based on cases around the world and across the nation. So go ahead, check it out. Go to crimewatchers.net today. Get a free account and join in on the conversation. You'll be glad you did. All right. So before we discuss our sponsors for today's show and also continuing to the story, I do want to let our listeners know that the contents of today's episode, once again, is going to be extremely graphic. So this is your final warning, listeners. If you're not into descriptions involving sexual abuse or murder or anything like that, because this is a pretty detailed graphic homicide, I would suggest that you go ahead and move on to another podcast. Otherwise, we do want to go ahead and move forward and let everybody know that today's episode, we had to scrounge around for resources, because normally in active open homicide investigations, you're not going to get access to a homicide file very easily. So we had to basically compile a list of resources from across the web, through newspapers, in order to get our story. Because if you're going to use public information as a resource for your story, you got to make sure that you have all of the accurate information that you can get. And a lot of the resources that we compiled has come from different newspapers like the Spokesman Review, the Spokane Chronicle, and we've also got information from the Spokane Police Department based on public statements that they've made over the years on the newspapers and stuff like that. And we also have information from the Spokane County Medical Examiner's Office that we've compiled as well. I do want to let our listeners know that we do intend to reach out to the Spokane County Medical Examiner's Office at some point to see if they would like to give us a public statement regarding this case, or maybe if someone from their office wants to do an interview with us. So when that happens, we'll let everybody know, and we'll go forward from there.
I guess I also want to give a shout out to the Hellbeasts blog. It's unfortunately no longer available, but it was the blog that I'd actually first come across this case, as well as various other ones. And the archive files are still around if you go to archive.org and paste the URL. The author, she comes from Canada, and she did a lot of entries about Jane Doe's. She did a couple of John Doe's as well. And she also is a self-taught forensic artist. And because of her amazing work on that website, she also was able to do some work with the Volusia County Sheriff's Office. And she was able to create a few reconstructions for them. And I just want to give her a shout out for all the hard work she did. And she also helped give us some information about this case, too, based on the archive file of her entry on Millie.
Yeah, absolutely. That was a really good resource as well. And yeah, it just sucks that the blog is not there anymore, but hopefully she's doing all right.
Yeah, definitely. I guess time will tell. I'm hoping she'll start it up again, but we'll see.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, so let's go ahead and start talking about Millie Doe, Nick.
Alrighty.
All right, so where to begin? Let's go ahead and take our listeners back to June 20th of 1984. Now, at this point, Spokane is still an up-and-coming city in the Pacific Northwest. They like to call themselves the Inland Northwest because basically it is the gateway to the Pacific Northwest. And also, it's about less than 2 hours south of the Canadian border. So it's an interesting little spot. It's quiet in 1984. It's up-and-coming. Things are starting to gain traction. And with that being said, these two young fishermen, they were fishing along the Spokane River in Spokane, Washington, and they noticed that something was floating on the west side of the river near the T.J. Menasche Bridge. Now, I think I said that correctly. I'm not from there, so it could be...
it's anybody's guess.
Exactly. I'm just going to go with it. Menasche. So anyways... Anyways, the area is close to the Spokane Falls Community College, which is also a sprawling campus off the banks of the Spokane River. As the fishermen got close, they realized that they had come across the decomposing, dismembered torso of a woman who had been missing her hands, legs, and head. And immediately, the two contacted the Spokane Police Department, and soon a crime scene was established. Now, it's important to note that when she was dismembered, and I say torso loosely, because it really wasn't necessarily just a torso. She still had her limbs, which I'll explain in just a second here once we start talking about the autopsy. When they did find this woman, they contacted the police department, and Detective Gene McGugan is assigned to this case. Now, Gene McGugan, he's one of Spokane's elite detectives. In fact, he would go on to have a very storied career with the Spokane Police Department. But yeah, he gets involved with this case. And then him and his team, they collect evidence at the scene. And it was apparent from Detective McGugan's initial view of the body that the dismemberment was done deliberately to conceal any way of identifying the woman. And it was additionally difficult to determine how long the body had been there in the water. Because you have to remember, in the Pacific Northwest, and honestly, in my opinion, water bodies west of the Mississippi tend to be pretty cold. So when the medical examiner had went out there, well, I should say the coroner, the temperature of the water was at 45 degrees. So this body was pretty preserved in this water. So it was really difficult to determine how long the body was in there. It could have been a couple of days. It could have been a couple of weeks. But there's been a couple of theories surrounding how long her body had been there.
Yeah, it's definitely a lot different from places like Florida, where I've heard of several cases where people have thrown bodies into rivers or, you know, into the ocean, and within days they're unrecognizable, if not, you know, less than 24 hours. It's very different from, you know, up north, you know, especially like in Wisconsin. I feel like the Wisconsin River has always been obnoxiously cold, because where I'm from, we have access to it, and it definitely, when a body of water is at a low temperature, it can preserve a body for a lot longer than one would think. You know, for me, whenever I hear somebody sound in a body of water, I generally just assume that if they've been there for more than a few days, they're going to be in pretty poor condition. But
sure,
a lot of times the cold water can help stall decomposition or at least slow it down. So, I mean, that might help keep a victim recognizable. Obviously, it didn't help in this case, but also does conceal, you know, perhaps how long ago the person died. And that can be difficult when you're getting down to zoning in on the killer and when, you know, they had the opportunity to dispose of the body. But of course, that wasn't a factor here. Millie's killer is still a mystery, as is her identity.
Sure, absolutely. And, you know, and I was thinking about how when a body sits in water for a long period of time, and you're absolutely correct, Nick, when you say about Florida water, you know, when someone's dumped in, say, for instance, the Everglades, the body is going to definitely be decomposing a lot faster because temperatures tend to be a little warmer than maybe Green Bay, Wisconsin. And essentially, it's kind of like, and I hate to use this term, but it tends to have a boil effect to it, if you will, where basically this big old heavy body is getting cooked by the sun in this standing body of water. And I hate to be graphic about it. And I can also give a perfect example of this, too. In Alabama, we're going to be covering this case on Sylvia Dowdle, who was found in a body of water in southern Alabama. Now, the thing about that case is that she was in that water for well over a week. And when they found her, she was heavily decomposed. Surprisingly, she was not extremely decomposed, but you could tell based on her feet and her hands that it was not doing kind things to her body. Like, there's a term that's used for that called washerwoman hand. And essentially what washerwoman hand does is that, okay, I'll put it this way. Nick, have you ever been in a body of water for so long that your hands get wrinkled up?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so imagine that, but like 10 times over.
Yeah, and plus, well, another thing too is that when the body is also decomposing, it causes a lot of bloating, and it definitely, from all that bacteria, it swells everything to the point where within a short amount of time, no features are recognizable. And unfortunately, I have come across images of those who have been left in bodies of water. One instance was in a Forensophiles case detailing the murders of a woman and her two daughters in Florida. They were victims of Oba Chandler, and it had only been 3 days, but there were crime scene photos of one of the victim's hands, and you could tell, you know, if her hands looked that bad, you know, you can't imagine what they looked like facially, and you know, visual identification is impossible at that point.
So probably a pretty bad washerwoman hand.
Yeah.
Pretty bad. But in this case, though, for Millie's case, we really couldn't tell because she didn't have no hands or feet in this situation. And on that note, though, that's the problem, is that in Washington State, and especially the Spokane River, it's pretty cold in there. So they could not necessarily tell how long Millie's body had been in that river. So they had to basically make special preparations because they wanted to go ahead and make sure that they could get all the details done on Millie. So what ended up happening, they needed to make some special arrangements for this situation because obviously there's no way to identify this woman without her head or her hands. The Spokane County Coroner at the time, Dr. Dexter Amend, ordered an autopsy on the Jane Doe. And Dr. Amend ended up asking medical examiner Donald Rie of Seattle to come to Spokane and do the autopsy. The purpose of Dr. Rie's performance was to locate any identifying features on the Jane Doe that could help in determining who she was, where she may have come from, and most importantly, how she died. Now, additionally, Spokane police was asked to attempt to locate the rest of her body before Dr. Rie arrived. When she was autopsied on, there was no way to determine how she died. There was no evidence on the body that could help guide Dr. Rie to an answer. However, he did note that there was a 1.5-inch oval horizontal scar on her left kneecap, a faint 1/4-inch scar on her right kneecap, and an oblique scar of her left arm that measured 3.5 inches in length. And then additionally, two prominent nevi moles were located on the front of her neck that would have stood out to anyone that met her. And then, this is where we get to a very interesting part of the autopsy. When it came time to examine for signs of sexual abuse, Dr. Rie found evidence that she had been sexually molested, according to the Spokesman Review. There was bruising in the vaginal area and a tear in her rectum.
And this definitely shows the absolute sickness of her attacker. From when I looked over the case, it was said to be a blunt object, so she wasn't necessarily conventionally raped, but
she
it was still
sodomized.
Yes, and that really shows that whoever killed her definitely wanted her to feel powerless. He wanted her to suffer, just feel violated in every possible way. And it definitely shows a lot of hate and animosity And I know to a lot of people in the past, I know even investigators were saying that she was probably killed by somebody she knew well, and that could even have been like a significant other perhaps. But I know from what I've read about serial killers is that a lot of times they will attack a perfect stranger, and you know, sometimes it reminds them of somebody who wronged them in the past, and sometimes it's just repressed rage or the need to inflict violence on somebody. So that could go either way.
Oh, absolutely. And yeah, like just based on the descriptions that we're getting based on Millie's case, you know, I think she definitely suffered in her final minutes of life, and it's just really awful. Like, someone could just go ahead and do something like this, like, you know, sexually assault this woman and then kill her the way that they killed her, and then, you know, how they disposed her body, you know, there was just definitely no regard for her life whatsoever. And one has to wonder, what did she do to supposedly deserve this murder? Which I have said in the previous episode, no one ever deserves to be murdered. Well, most people don't deserve to be murdered. But in Millie's case, what did she do to really piss somebody off to this point? Or what did she not do to make this happen? You know what I mean?
Yeah, it definitely, to me, I kind of feel like if this was somebody she knew, it definitely, to me, it points out a significant other, because I don't think, you know, a friend necessarily would have done this unless, you know, advances were rejected by her. But
sure.
Part of me still thinks, you know, if she was perhaps a lady of the night, pardon the expression, I feel like too is whoever might have decided to take her life, an insignificant object. Prostitution was fairly common in the area in the 80s, and I'm sure whoever this was, a random killing, I definitely think that somebody felt her to be a disposable object to do whatever with, and perhaps she didn't want to do certain things. Perhaps she was just a pedestrian in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Sure.
And, you know, I guess just as we were talking about this, I almost wonder, too, the fact that she wasn't conventionally raped could also point to a woman as the killer. It's not common for crimes of this nature to be committed by women statistically. I mean, I'm sure, you know, I'm sure plenty of women out there are capable of this, but statistically, I don't see a lot of cases where this level of violence occurs unless, you know, there's a significant amount of anger towards the victim, and that could actually reinforce the theory that she knew her killer.
Sure, totally. Although I think Lizzie Borden would disagree with you.
Yeah.
But no, I say that with jest. But yeah, I mean, totally. It could be anybody. I mean, it could be a woodsman. It could have been an old preacher man. Or hell, it could have been the preacher man's wife. Who knows? You know, it could have been anybody. But, you know, as we continue on, it might make you think maybe perhaps this was a domestic situation, especially when we continue and the more discoveries that we make along the way, especially a decade later. So, yeah, so stay with us. We're getting somewhere with all this. But on that note, I did want to talk about the method that she was dismembered. Now, this was definitely someone with no skill whatsoever about dismembering somebody. So, obviously, whoever dismembered her had no idea what they were doing, because these were rough cut. They say the medical examiner believed that this person was dismembered with either a hatchet, an axe, or a knife, and that the cuts were definitely not clean, meaning that the blade may have been dull when she was dismembered. Now, I do recall in an article in 2007 by the online newspaper Seattle PI, and now this is the part where it gets a little more graphic. Seattle PI indicated that the medical examiner of Spokane County believed the woman may have actually been dismembered while she was still cognitive, while she was still alive. However, you know, this has been another topic of debate, because, like I said, you know, we don't know what happened when she was alive. Yes, there's definitely signs that it could have been an antemortem dismemberment, but you have to also remember, too, that this woman's body was in cold water for a long period of time. It could have altered damage. It could have altered a number of things. It definitely altered the decomposition process, but do you think that she was dismembered while she was alive, Nick?
I definitely don't want to consider that possibility just because it's absolutely horrific, but it definitely could have happened, you know, especially if this was somebody who really hated her and wanted her to suffer, and means. There are definitely killers out there who are basically sadists, and they want to inflict as much pain possible while the person is still alive. Mm-hmm. And there have been actually a few doe cases where victims have been said to have been alive when this sort of thing happens. It's rare, but it definitely shows that it amplifies the obvious evil that this individual had when they killed her. It's terrifying to think that. I'm assuming that if this did happen when she was alive, you know, he started with the non-fatal injuries first, and then gradually, or they, I should say they, because of course we don't know.
Sure.
But well, yeah, you know.
And I do recall, like, in some instances that there were times when, like, Ted Bundy, when he was murdering his victims, he was really being a sadist in his attacks on some of these women, where he was slowly killing them. He would torture them by raping them many times, beating them with blunt objects, stuff like that, and leaving them in the woods to die. And as they're dying, he would come back and just keep abusing them until they died. And then afterwards, you know, that sick bastard still abused them, even in death.
Yeah, and I do feel that if they ever do catch who did this, you know, this is going to be behavior that has potentially existed in previous offenses. I can definitely see this person having a history of sexual violence towards women, and, you know, it definitely makes me wonder if Millie's the only victim.
Exactly. And that's why, since I learned about this case a couple of years ago, I've tried to see if I could link her case to other cases throughout the Pacific Northwest and throughout the West itself, and other places, but unfortunately I wasn't able to really find too much about other cases that might have been similar to hers in that time span. Although, ironically, there was another woman around the same time who was murdered. She was murdered just a couple of days before Millie was found, and yeah, she was stabbed to death.
Yeah, and when I did read about that case, you know, it's the matter of days does kind of make you wonder if they could be related. Police did say they couldn't find a necessary link between these cases, and also the fact that the victim was clothed and she had not been dismembered does possibly have an inconsistency with the MO. But then again, sometimes serial killers stick to that and sometimes they don't.
Exactly. And that's something we'll explain a little later, too.
And I guess another thing, too, this happened quite a few years after Millie was discovered. But in 1997, a woman named Teresa Lynn Asmussen was beaten to death, and she was thrown into the Spokane River and had a history of prostitution. There wasn't evidence of dismemberment. From what I read, there's very few details about it, but, you know, probably the closest similarity of a case to Millie's that I've been able to find. There's very little information otherwise that could point to additional victims.
Definitely, yeah. I can agree with that, because, you know, if someone was using the same dumping grounds where Millie was found, then perhaps, you know, it's something that this killer was familiar with. However, we also have to keep in mind, too, that murder occurred about 14 years later, so you have to figure out, you know, if this was going to be a regular spot for him, why only two people? You know what I mean?
Yeah, and that's always what makes it complicated when you're sleuthing and trying to think about, you know, could these cases be related? And, you know, some offenders can go years without killing, and some of them have that unquenchable thirst to attack more people. And sometimes, you know, it happens within a matter of days and weeks, and there's just not a whole lot of other connections that can be made to other cases.
Mm-hmm, exactly. And I want to go ahead and move forward with another observation that was made, a very important observation at that, that was made by Dr. Ray. She may have actually borne a child in her life. There was evidence to suggest that she was pregnant at one time. And, well, if that's the case, she's got a kid walking around somewhere that's wondering where their mom is.
And that's what's really sad, is because I remember I've heard about so many cases where children of murdered people, you know, live their lives thinking they were abandoned by their parents, and it turns out that they were murdered during their early childhood. You know, it's definitely something that really tugs at your heart, because growing up without a certain parental figure in your life can be significantly damaging to somebody, and there's a lot of things you wonder about, you know, what happened to this child? Did they live their life? Are they doing all right? Or did their life fall apart because of this? There's a lot of possibilities, but it definitely makes you wonder about how much, you know, this woman's loved ones were affected.
Absolutely. I completely agree with that, because we have cases, like lots of these, you know, mainstream cases, like we're going to be talking about one particular missing woman that was connected in this case in some weird way. And her son was in prison in Alabama. So, like, there's a couple of things, you know, where you consider maybe perhaps the death of a loved one caused for their life to go on a downward spiral. But then you have individuals like Precious Dowdle, whose mother I was just talking about earlier. You know, she uses that to influence her life, to use it as a message to others that cases can be solved if you put your strength and mind together and do something with it instead of just letting it sit on a shelf for so long.
Yeah, and I remember there's another case, a woman who she was killed in 1980, and it wasn't until about, I want to say 2000, that her remains were finally identified, and it was through the help of her daughter, and they were able to solve the crime after the identification because they were finally able to conclusively link the victim to her estranged husband. And during that process, the victim's daughter had finally revealed to police about years of abuse and things that she'd witnessed while her mother was still alive. And it's definitely traumatic, but at the same time, it still can be enough to motivate somebody to, you know, come forward, move past the trauma, and seek justice.
Absolutely. And so, like, that's the thing, is that they think that Millie had a baby sometime in her life, and, you know, she had stretch marks in her abdomen area and around her breast, and it also appeared that she also had spina bifida occulta, which is a birth defect that is familial to the spina bifida disorder, but it is much more hidden than its main counterpart, which means that it's possible that she may have experienced back pain in her life, which occulta, the spina bifida occulta, is not necessarily something that's paralyzing or anything like that. Think of it similar to scoliosis. Scoliosis causes back pain. Your posture isn't right. With this particular situation, you know, I feel like she may have had back pain in her life. Maybe didn't even know she had spina bifida.
There's actually are several cases I've read about too where they observe spinal bifida occulta in victims, but, you know, they always say it is possible that the victim was unaware of this medical condition. And it's kind of interesting that the medical examiner or coroner can discover this one issue where in life, you know, if this person is reported missing, that detail might be absent from the report because the person didn't know they had it.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, A lot of us walk around, you know, with medical disorders that we may or may not even know about yet. And it's usually not till we're much older that we find out about them. And I think in this case, you know, she didn't know she had spina bifida. So maybe she thought that a little bit of back pain that she was having was probably from, like, you know, pregnancy, or she strained her back somehow. But, well, sometimes you just happen to have something you don't even know about yet. Mm-hmm. And I also wanted to go back to her cause of death a little bit. So at this point in time, we didn't know how she died, because you have to remember there was no alcohol in her system, no drugs in her system, there were no gunshot wounds, no stab marks in her body, anything like that. All we had to go on was the fact that she was dismembered. Whether she was dismembered alive, we don't know. But in a 2015 post by Carl Koppelman on Web Sleuths, the woman's cause of death was by sharp force trauma. Now, again, this points toward the fact that she may have been dismembered alive, but also remember, once again, that there were no other signs of how she died. And that's where I'm just like, how does someone figure this out? Like, you know, with the Fred Laster case, they didn't have anywhere to go regarding his death. It was an undetermined homicide, because there was no signs of Freddie getting shot or getting strangled or anything like that. All they had was the fact that his torso was dismembered.
I guess because the head was absent, kind of wonder if there could have been strangulation as a factor as well, and that was, of course, hidden by the fact that her head was absent. And, of course, there's really no way to tell, you know, it's obviously a homicide based on the evidence of sexual assault and the level of efforts this person made to conceal her identity. That can also be an issue when the case is being brought to trial, because the defense can always point and claim that it was an accidental death and they were trying to cover up their tracks.
Sure. Oh, totally. And yeah, you know, that's just one thing that kind of boggles my mind is that, you know, if the autopsy, the initial autopsy was saying sharp force trauma, how did they even know that? You know, like, do they think that maybe she got her head split by an axe, which we would find out later wasn't the case, but are they making educated guesses at this point?
I guess it's definitely hard to tell because, you know, we don't have the medical examiner's file, unfortunately. We don't have the police report in this case, unfortunately.
Yeah, so we'll go ahead and move forward with another discovery that was made 1 month later on July 18th of 1984. A dog dragged a severed hand onto a yard near the Indian Canyon Golf Course in Spokane. The hand had been badly decomposed, and the dog's chewing created additional damage to the hand. When Detective McGugan caught wind of the hand, he immediately suspected that the hand belonged to the woman. Because of its advanced decomposition, it was hard to determine whether the hand belonged to a man or a woman. However, the Jane Doe's case was the only nearby dismemberment case, which only made sense that, well, the hand belonged to her. Then, pretty much after that, the Spokane Police Department sent the hand to the FBI in Quantico, Virginia, for fingerprints. With that, the FBI was able to return 4 partial fingerprints and a palm print. However, none of the prints matched with what the FBI had in their system. From there, the Spokane Police Department went through 10,000 fingerprint cards in their possession to see if the prints would match. However, by the end of their counts, their efforts became fruitless. 10,000 fingerprint cards. Aren't we glad we live in a technological world now?
Yeah, I can't imagine how many hours this would have taken. Thankfully, now we have APHIS, which, you know, will automatically compare prints, and then if a tentative match is made, at least, you know, they still have examiners look over and decide whether or not it's a false positive or not. But, you know, I definitely can't imagine detective work at this point in time where they didn't have things like this and they had to do it all by hand, and I feel like I would go insane if I was doing this kind of work.
Mm-hmm. Same here, and I'm glad I'm not a detective back in the 80s. But nonetheless, though, from what I understand, now this is kind of an awful thing to discuss here too, the hand was somehow misplaced in evidence, and pretty much they lost this hand. So they have no idea where the hell this hand is. So thankfully, before that had happened, they had taken DNA from the hand. Now, what ended up happening was they were able to match this hand up with the Jane Doe that they had, and it was a negative. This hand did not belong to Millie. So pretty much they were back at square one with the hand. So yeah, that was pretty bad.
Yeah, today that hand has its own separate NamUs file. The identity was never confirmed, and they still don't know whether it belonged to a man or a woman.
Yeah. Well, but yes, yeah, I mean, you're right, yeah. Pretty much after they essentially ruled this hand out as being Millie's hand, they pretty much gave this hand its own profile. And so if anyone knows anything about it, you can go to NamUs, check out the Spokane County Medical Examiner's listings on NamUs, and you can find that profile on there. Something you can point out later, Nick. Mm-hmm. So over the years, no fresh leads came into the picture regarding this case. And, well, of course, this Jane Doe was ruled out as being the victim of the Green River killer, Gary Ridgway. And obviously, even though Bundy Mania was happening all over the world, well, all over the country, she definitely was not a victim of Ted Bundy, because at this point, he's been sitting in death row for years at this point, waiting to be executed in Florida. So this was definitely not related. But there was another serial killer that was ravaging the streets of Spokane, and they called him the Spokane Serial Killer. And so what he was doing was he was targeting sex workers that would line Spokane Sprague Avenue, then would dump them in numerous parts of Spokane. And eventually that killer would be arrested in 1999 and identified as Robert Lee Yates. He targeted sex workers that would line Spokane Sprague Avenue. Then he would dump their bodies in numerous parts of Spokane. And eventually, he would be caught because one of his victims escaped harm from him. She was able to escape his clutches and was able to give the police information on this guy. And, well, when this guy was arrested and identified as Robert Lee Yates in 1999, she was able to point him out in a lineup.
Yeah. From what I've read is that Yates was active as early as 1975 at least. Mm-hmm. So he had a lot of time to have sought out victims, and he wasn't caught until, you know, a significant amount of time after he first started. So
right.
There's definitely a possibility that he's killed much more than the 11 victims that he was convicted of.
Right, yeah, because you have to remember, you know, with Yates, he murdered a man and woman in Walla Walla, Washington in 75, and he moved around the state quite a bit before he settled into Spokane. However, he was also in the military as well, and that's where I was kind of getting with Yates. Whether or not Millie was the victim of a serial killer, you know, that's been debated for a long time following her discovery. And some investigators, you know, have expressed their doubts, especially when it came to Robert Lee Yates. By the mid-2000s, another stated that the brutality of the crime suggested that the offender had probably killed before. And early reports ended up stating that it was likely that she knew her killer very well, perhaps explaining the ferocity of her murder. That's the thing, too, and we touched up on that a minute ago, is that There was that chance that she probably knew her killer. She must have really pissed somebody off that she knew to a point that they knew they could get away with murdering her.
Most definitely, and as far as the dismemberment goes, going at this length, you know, you've got to have a strong stomach, and it does, you know, suggest that there is a possibility this person has killed before, but the fact that the wounds are said to have been done in an amateurish fashion, it starts to kind of indicate, too, that, you know, this could have been an isolated incident. I mean, there's really not much to go on. There's so many different possibilities that, you know, I can see why investigators are still stumped on whether or not she had been killed by one person who never killed again, or by somebody who was fairly experienced. And the severed hand not matching her suggests to me that perhaps there are more victims out there that just weren't found or identified.
Sure, totally. And with the fact that Spokane is a big county, Spokane County is really big, there ain't no telling, you know, how many bodies have been dumped in that area. I mean, there's a lot of land out there that is barely walked upon. So, yeah, there's no telling, really. But I will go on record and say this, though. Yates can be ruled out in this case, and I'll tell you why. There's a lot of forums, there's a lot of videos, there's anything so on and so forth of people trying to suggest that Yates was maybe responsible for Millie's murder. However, he was nowhere near Washington State when she was murdered. Military records indicate that Yates was stationed at Fort Rucker, Alabama in 1984, thereby ruling him out in this murder. And additionally, Yates' MO was shooting his victims in the head numerous times, then wrapping their heads with plastic bags. What happens next in this case, especially around the same time that the prostitute murders were happening, they end up finding something very important that will help investigators in the Millie Doe case. And that would happen on April 19th of 1998. A woman walking her dog near 7th and Sherman Avenues on the east side of Spokane was alerted by her dog to human remains that were located in an empty lot on the corner of the intersection. Investigators were alerted to the area where they located a skull with some of the vertebrae attached to it. And the site where that skull was found once was home to the historical Sharon Temple Christian Methodist Episcopal Church. That's a mouthful. Mm-hmm. And it was torn down in 1989 due to it being vacant for several years. So the initial idea was perhaps this church had a cemetery on the property, and maybe skeletal remains had been unearthed after a period of time, because this was an older church. So there could have been an old set of remains that just happened to be dug up. Earlier reports about the skull being discovered indicated that there were other, you know, bits of remains scattered about. However, as we would find out later, that was either false or the bones belonged to animals. Because you also have to remember, too, that when this church was torn down, it is essentially turned into a dumping ground where salvage could, well, it could be regularly found. And children would often play in the open space as well. So there was interesting activity going on over there. And then, in fact, too, sex workers would continue using that area as well, you know, for late night excursions, if you will.
And I also recall reading, too, that there was some drug activity in that neighborhood. Of course, after when, you know, parents were interviewed about the discovery and how a lot of them even were polarized about the safety of the neighborhood. And honestly, yeah. I feel like if a body was found on the block I was living, I'd get the hell out of there. But I guess it just depends. And especially wouldn't want to raise my children there. That's for damn sure.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, hey, you know, when you were 2 years old, there was a torso they found down the street. It was full of bugs and stuff. But you were too young to remember that. That, right? Yeah. But anyways, I digress though. But yeah, I mean, this area here, and even today, is still a rough neighborhood. I've been to Spokane before, and well, honestly, the city itself is getting pretty rough. But that part of town, according to my friend Hector, he was telling me that tended to be a very rough section of town. So, you know, that would be a place where you wouldn't want to necessarily walk by yourself at night. So yeah, when they found the skull, you know, they blocked off this area, excavated it, and then they brought the skull to the medical examiner's office. Now, the examination of the skull suggested that she suffered blunt force trauma, causing injuries to the mandible and lower portion of her face. And for some time, investigators were not able to identify who the skull belonged to until, through DNA, they were able to match that skull with the human remains found 14 years earlier. However, the match would not be confirmed until 2000. And then soon after, a forensic sketch artist from Cataldo, Idaho, crafted a likeness for this Jane Doe, which would be distributed across the Northwest. And it's a decent reconstruction, I think. I mean, at least for the time being, I think it was definitely a very good temporary placeholder for what Carl Koppelman would end up doing later.
I guess, too, one thing that has to be noted about this sketch is that I have seen Millie's skull, and I definitely have to say that she definitely had a much more prominent, squarer shape than this reconstruction shows. So I definitely don't want to say, like, this hindered identification, because obviously more reconstructions have been made that might show a more accurate depiction, but it's definitely important that certain features are emphasized if they are present instead of making them look more generic. But still, I mean, it was definitely a very good thing that somebody actually went ahead and did that sketch, because in my opinion, that's a very, very vital part of identifying a set of remains, is to have a face.
Oh, absolutely. And I think, you know, Carrie Parks, the lady who did this art, she did a great job on it. If the only criticism that I would have is that she should have emphasized the jawline a little more. Because as we would find out later, and as you just mentioned, it's good to have those features emphasized. And I do recall in the article that she did in 2007 with the medical examiner of Spokane County, at the time, which was Sally Aiken, they mentioned that she didn't want to necessarily emphasize some features because she didn't want, I guess, people who are going to be looking at this art to necessarily say, oh, so this is exactly what she looked like. However, I do kind of necessarily find that it would definitely be true and false in some ways, because now here we are, you know, before Carl Koppelman even gets a whiff of this case, people are looking at this sketch and they're going around looking for someone who looks exactly like that.
Yeah, and I think that's, I guess, one thing about forensic art that a lot of people don't know about, is that it's an educated guess. And of course, you know, the techniques have improved significantly over the years, but still, you know, I've I've seen plenty of cases where this really well done lifelike image is created and then it doesn't quite resemble the living photo of the victim. Of course, then again, I mean, living photos also differ because they can be taken at different angles than the reconstruction is created in. And so I guess you can still make it look pretty, but it doesn't mean it's accurate.
Exactly. Correct. Yep. I completely agree on that. And on that note, too, you know, we were talking about that interview that, you know, Ms. Parks did. In 2007, the spokesman review ended up doing a huge story on this case, which included deeper insight into how the head found in 1998 was connected to this torso. And I remember seeing a quote from Detective Don Geese saying, you know, this, it was kind of like connecting a puzzle piece, you know. They were able to excavate Millie's grave, take the skull and the vertebrae that was attached to it, and then essentially put it together with the rest of her torso.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely kind of a grisly image that you get in your head, but it definitely must have been the aha moment for them when, hey, we can finally move forward in this case. We found our head. We can get additional details about perhaps what she might have looked like, and now they have dental records. And, you know, definitely dental records are very important with making identifications. You know, this was, you know, in 2000 when they made that connection through DNA, but at the same time, you know, there's plenty of other cases where, you know, DNA testing isn't performed and dental records are still sufficient enough to show that it was the same person.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And one thing that really, really interests me is that after so long, her skull was still, you know, in perfect shape. Like, it was still in good shape. None of it, like, rotted away or separated due to weathering or anything like that. Like, it amazed me how really, like, how good a shape the skull was in.
Yeah, and that kind of reminds me of the Horseshoe Harriet case in Alaska. She was a victim of Robert Hansen, and after they exhumed her body after 30 years, the skull was in such bad shape they couldn't even do reconstruction.
Right.
And, you know, I still hope, you know, they have at least photographs of the skull that maybe they can do something with that. But, you know, it's been 6 years since they exhumed her. But I guess time will tell. We'll see what happens.
Yeah, maybe even Anthony Redgrave can probably do a reconstruction on her just using the photos.
Yeah, he's done it before.
Yeah, I know, that's right?
Yep.
I have personal experience with that.
Yep.
But on that note, though, the spokesman review also gave us a little more insight into how Millie got her name, which I think was the cutest thing ever, despite how, you know, grisly this whole story is. But, you know, they were basically, it was Detective Don Geese and his daughter. And by the way, once again, I hope I'm pronouncing his last name correctly. It seems like I've done that three times already. But, you know, they go to a hotel. They're on their way to Western Washington to go see a forensic anthropologist to see what they can do with this skull. And while they're in the hotel room, you know, they're watching TV, having casual time with a skeleton, with a skull in the room. And then the daughter goes and says, hey, you know, we've got another person in this room. Why don't we give this person a name? And she named the skull Millie. And since then, the name Millie stuck.
And I think that actually does kind of help humanize victims somewhat. You know, I know some people have voiced that it's not appropriate, I know, with like archaeological finds. But I know with cases like Beth Doe or various others, you know, having a nickname for the victim gives them a more, you kind of have a more realistic feeling that, you know, they were a person, they had hopes and dreams, they had a life, and I think it kind of helps feel some more interest in the case. You know, just like Princess Doe back in 1982, you know, 38 years ago, the detectives wanted to give her a name to have her stand out from all the other Jane Does in the world, and, you know, I think that's what's really helped keep her case so special to so many others that, you know, she's not just Jane Doe, she's Princess Doe.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, and I think giving a name to a Doe case definitely helps when trying to get the name out there, or trying to get the case out there. Like, you know, for instance, you know, naming the find after the city, like Lake City John Doe or Findlay Creek Jane Doe, you know, stuff like that. It stands out. It's catchy. It pops. You know, it rolls off the tip of your tongue. And it's a really good way to remember these cases and keep talking about them. And that's and so essentially, you know, giving them a name brings them back to life in a way. Especially. But yeah, so like that's the thing, is that since that special was done and, you know, everything was being discussed about this Jane Doe, you know, tips have poured in over the years, and as they come in, essentially all the tips end up leading to dead ends. No one's come forward with information pertaining to a woman that went missing in the area, or has anyone come forward with information about who killed her? Although I will say online sleuths have come close to an identification regarding this woman. It was about a woman who had gone missing in Arizona in 1980. However, the woman, Sheila Ann Polly, was ruled out as this Jane Doe, despite sharing similarities like the gap, the moles on her neck, stuff like that. And honestly, I'll guarantee you, if dental records were not a thing to use, if DNA was not a thing to use, if all they had was a family member saying, "Oh, that's my daughter," I guarantee you that this woman would probably be in Arizona, wrongfully identified.
Yeah, and honestly, I was quite shocked when I found out that Sheila Polly had been ruled out, because, you know, the mole locations were very similar. You know, she had that gap in her teeth, and the photograph of Sheila that is available does bear a striking resemblance to Carl's image. And, you know, I don't think I have been more surprised about a potential match turning up negative, because the resemblance was so strong, and, you know, even physical characteristics matched up. So, and I guess, as I've said in other podcast episodes, you know, at least we know that Sheila Polly did not suffer this horrible death, that there is a chance she is still out there. It's still kind of a blow to the investigation when they can't track down who this individual was. And, you know, after the identification is made, that's generally when the search for the perpetrator really gets going.
Exactly. And, you know, after so many years, too, you know, you also have to think about it this way as well, is that, you know, this torso had been sitting in the river for so long that I'd guarantee you that any kind of, you know, physical evidence, like any kind of DNA, would be gone. Although there was a part in the article, the spokesman that was talking about tape that had been found on Millie's arm, and it may have had DNA on this tape. That would be an interesting find if there was suspect DNA on that tape.
I guess that part's a little confusing to me, because I almost wonder, too, if that was referring to if the examiners had actually put the tape on her arm to remove, like, hair follicles and get DNA from that. So I guess that's a little unclear for me, so I'm not even sure if necessarily the tape was placed there by the killer, but I guess what is interesting, though, is I know in the past investigators have been able to actually identify a roll of tape in the suspect's home based on the based on, you know, the cutting patterns by matching them up on the separate ends. Obviously, after almost 40 years, this probably would be fairly impossible to do, but forensic technology still has a lot of surprises that I think a lot of people aren't necessarily aware of.
Oh, absolutely. I think the best is yet to come in forensic technology, in my opinion.
Yeah, I'm really excited to see what it'll be like in, you know, 10 years' time.
Oh, I could only imagine. At this point, they'll be able to use toenails and fingernails as a way of identifying somebody.
Yeah, if they haven't figured out already, I guess we'd have to do a little more research on that.
Right, exactly. But yeah, I mean, you know, to this day, though, despite changes in investigators, medical examiners, coroners, you know, Millie has yet to claim her real name. And, you know, revisions have also been made over the years, including a regularly updated forensic reconstruction of Millie by Carl Koppelman. And we've already talked about Carl in this episode, and you personally got an opportunity to talk to Carl.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I know from some of the statements that he's made about the case, he actually was provided with a postmortem photo of the torso, so he would know where to place the moles on that reconstruction, which I think was, it definitely shows that they value his work. I know a lot of people like to shut him down because he's self-taught. Of course, he did eventually get some training with Karen T. Taylor, who is a legend. But I think that's definitely very important that they're, I guess, essentially swallowing their pride, you know?
And, yeah, exactly.
And turning to him. And before his latest revision came out, I know it's actually been revised one other time after the Sheila Pauley investigation was going on. And before that, he'd also done a different version that it was a little more generic looking. Her mouth was closed. And he also did a profile reconstruction that hasn't been updated yet. But definitely when you compare that profile rendering that he did years ago with the one that exists now, you can definitely see how much he's evolved as an artist, and it's fascinating to me.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, his work, I mean, honestly, he could continue doing this for many years, and I think he could still be able to perfect each case that he's been able to work on. So I think that, you know, Carl's representation of this Jane Doe is probably going to be the most accurate depiction of this Jane Doe that you can find anywhere on the internet or anywhere else. And, you know, he's been involved with the Spokane Police Department for many years as well. He's worked on other cases with them as well. And he even helped solve a case out there as well.
Yeah, I do remember he did assist with the identification of Donald Nyden, who he was only a John Doe for a few days because of Carl's work. And I remember Carl told me that, you know, the remains were not in good condition, and it was difficult to work with, but they were still able to figure out who this guy was and, you know, line up, you know, the events leading up to his death, which was an accidental drowning, as far as I know.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, it all played out. So, I mean, he's got some pull with the Spokane Police Department, and he's been able to help them out with whatever they needed. And, yeah, and that's just the thing, is that, you know, essentially every original investigator in this case has since retired or have passed away. Like, for instance, Detective McGugan, he enjoyed a very successful career as a detective and was part of the effort to identify the South Hill rapist, Kevin Coe, who was the son of the Spokane Chronicle's managing editor, Gordon Coe. That's an interesting little tidbit right there about that man's career.
Yeah, and, you know, especially, you know, I guess being the son of a prominent figure in that newspaper, that's definitely a scandal that probably had people talking.
Yeah, it's kind of like the Max Factor heir, Andrew Luster. You know, he was an heir to the Max Factor throne, and then he ends up like brutally raping some woman or something like that. I think that's what the story was about. And then he ran off to Mexico, and then Dog the Bounty Hunter ends up catching him and stuff like that. And, you know, it's like, just because you're in power, they still do fucked up things, you know?
Absolutely.
You know, yeah, I mean, just because you're the, you know, editor's son, or you happen to be the son of a shampoo Shampoo King or something like that, you know, you're still liable to do something just as bad as you or I would be doing, you know.
And it also doesn't eliminate your chance of being caught. Sure, you know,
exactly.
Sure, your parents can pay for a really good lawyer, but the forensic evidence doesn't lie.
Yeah, obviously, unless you're Donald Trump, though.
Yeah, that's actually quite true.
Yeah, but boom. Anywho, moving on. But yeah, and then also Dr. Donald Ray, you know, he continued to work as the medical examiner for King County for a pretty long time. He ended up retiring in 1999, and he enjoyed living in Oak Harbor the rest of his days until passing away at the age of 81 in 2018. And ironically, Oak Harbor was a place where the Spokane serial killer was born.
Yeah, that's a coincidence. That's for sure.
But yeah, other than that, you know, there's really not a whole lot more we can share about Millie's case. And if we missed anything, I'm sure you're able to find it on the internet. But we've pretty much cleared everything that we could about Millie. We used a lot of resources to put this case together. And yeah, I think we did all right. Don't you think, Nick?
Absolutely. I'm really satisfied with how comprehensive this episode was. You know, I mean, I think at first we were a little discouraged just because we weren't allowed to get the police file. But, you know, we still had newspapers. We still had access to the internet. And I think we made it work with, you know, we definitely introduced some new details that hopefully will help make the public more aware and perhaps, you know, give those super sleuths enough information that they can create some new credible theories.
Absolutely. I agree. So here's my question to our listeners, though. Did you have a parent, a mom, that just happened to disappear sometime in the early 80s? Did your dad say something about, oh, she just ran off with another man, or she just disappeared out of nowhere? Was there excuses made? And were you not able to locate your mom? And I ask this question especially to our listeners in the Pacific Northwest because your input could be very valuable in a case like this, especially if you were from the Spokane area.
And I definitely have to add too that that could also support, you know, the argument of a domestic situation and could also explain why no missing people in the area have matched up to the Jane Doe, is that she may not have been reported missing.
Exactly. And that's why we need your help. We need your help to reach out to the Spokane Police Department and tell them what you know. Or anybody, for that matter. It doesn't even have to be this woman's kid. It could have been anybody who is familiar with this situation. That's why we're trying to see if anyone out there can help, you know? And that's the thing, is that even though you know something, you tell them, it's not going to hurt anybody in the long run. If anything, you're going to be helping somebody. You might actually be helping someone get out of a domestic violence situation. Think about that. So if you know something, say something. And that's why if you have any information on the Millie Doe case, especially information pertaining to her identification or the identification of her killer, you are urged to contact the Spokane Police Department at 509-477-2296. Again, that phone number is 509-477-2296. Please provide her case number 84-31733. Again, her case number is 84-31733. And additionally, you can contact the Spokane County Medical Examiner's Office at 509-477-2296. Again, that number is 509-477-2296. And remember, you can remain anonymous when you're reporting your tips regarding Millie's case. On that note, we're going to be getting ready for our next episode of From the Vault, where Nick will be hosting a very special episode dedicated to the memory of Amy Mihaljevic. Nick, go ahead and take it away.
I first came across the murder of Amy Mihaljevic when I was 12 years old. I came across the case of Amy Mihaljevic, which is still unsolved after over 30 years, and I followed the case for half of my life. It has always bothered me that her murder was never solved, and the brutality of the case still haunts me today. I'm very, very eager to start writing this episode and to really dig deep and even learn new things about the case. You know, I'm really honored that I get this opportunity to give details about this murder and hopefully to bring more awareness to it.
Absolutely. And it'll be an honor to be able to sit back and watch you host this episode. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it kind of gives me a little bit of a break from writing myself as well, but I will definitely still be here to do a lot of input on this case. Amy Mihaljevic's case is one you're not going to want to miss. And then after that, we'll be talking about Marjorie Luna as well. So we've got a lot of cases still on the table to discuss here at From the Vault. And once again, folks, if you do become a patron at Patreon, you will get the episodes early, and you'll get to listen in on what we have regarding each case. So go to patreon.com/fromthevaultpod and become a member. And on top of getting our episodes early, get free shit too. Can't beat that, can you?
No, I don't think you can.
Anyways, ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for listening to our episode on Millie today. We hope we were able to be very descriptive about her case and were able to share her story to the rest of the world, especially for those who have never heard of this case before. So we hope we were able to help you guys out with that. And with that, anything you want to add, Nick?
I guess I also do want to give some contact information regarding the unidentified hand that was discovered on July 18th, 1984 in Spokane. The Spokane County Sheriff's Office is investigating the case. Ask for Detective Lyle Johnston, and the phone number is 509-477-2240, 509-477-2240, and the agency case number is 84-36978. In addition, the Spokane County Medical Examiner's Office is also investigating the case, and please contact Elizabeth Nelson at 509-477-2296. That's 509-477-2296.
Yep, and that's also going to be the same number that you use and the same contact person if you wanted to contact them about Millie's case as well. So, yeah, keep those numbers in mind if you have any information regarding both cases. And also, I always encourage people, if you want to learn more about Washington's Doe cases, go to doenetwork.org. They have a really comprehensive list of Doe cases in that state. And also go to NamUs, and they have a lot more descriptive information regarding each Washington case. But with that being said, ladies and gentlemen, I want to thank you once again for listening to today's episode. I'm Jason Futch.
And I'm Nick Wagler.
And it's a pleasure having you guys listen to us today. We'll see you on the next episode of From the Vault.